RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So as of this morning, we understand the Inter-Island Ferry on a teddy, which I note in the media has been pointed out means quick pace, is in the harbour in Picton following its grounding on its approach to Picton over the weekend. And there's been a lot said about that, and we thought we'd get a real ship's captain on to get his views on what could have happened and what it means for the vessel in the meantime. Captain Kevin Judkins. And if you remember back to, I think it was about this time last year, we talked to Kevin on a completely different subject, the mistreatment of New Zealand seafarers during the COVID lockdowns. Captain Judkins, thanks for coming back to RCR.
Thank you, Paul. Nice to be on your show. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, so I want to kind of go through this the way it's been reported and what we know, which I've just mentioned up to this point. So this ferry's been in existence and in service for nearly 30 years, 26 years. Is that old for a vessel, or is that sort of mid-age? Where does that sit?
That is old for a vessel currently in operation. So the only older vessel on the coast, that, to my knowledge, is the Tangaroa. She's 35 years old. But for a functioning roll-on, roll-off vessel that's on a daily schedule, then that is old for a vessel, yes.
All right. So we understand that there was what looked like maintenance first on steering gear on board the ship. And I noticed some people are calling it a boat in the media. It's a ship, right? It's not a dinghy. It's an actual ship. I think one of the Kiwi Rail top brass said that they were looking for a part. They couldn't get it locally, would take time. So they kind of reset the entire steering system of the vessel. Seems software is involved. And they've been testing it, it looks like, right up to the point where it sailed again commercially. So would that be a normal way of doing things, or would that be a fast-track way of doing maintenance? If a part's available, but it takes too long to get, you look for a workaround? I guess that's fair enough.
It is fair enough. We're not saying fix it with number 8Y by any means there. But obviously, the vessel has a schedule to keep, and we don't want to compromise safety. Obviously, is the first priority, but they have that business run, they have a schedule to keep. Assuming that the parts were were reputable parts, and that the tests were done correctly and performed as designed, then I would have no issues with that.
Okay, so testing. I've heard the term sea trials used before, and that sort of kind of conjures up images of it actually being out at sea to test it. We don't know if that's happened, but that would be the normal course, would it? You'd take it out into the open sea, put it through a whole lot of manoeuvres, everything you can think of, sign it off, and then she's good to go.
Now, sea trials is more for testing engine repairs or after a dry dock or a significant layup period. That's more sea trials. All ships test their steering gear prior to leaving port, prior to arriving in port. They give it a real port and starboard to check that they're working, and they might alternate the steering motors down in the steering flat themselves. Just be aware that there's sort of two completely different components to the steering system. One is the electro-hydraulic system that's down in the steering flat that's connected directly to the rudders. Then you have the control systems up on the bridge, which give the electrical signal to that electro-hydraulic system down aft. So we're talking two systems that are on the Aratiri 130 metres apart. So there's lots of control systems in between those. But just be careful when you talk about the steering system is more down at the steering flat where the rudder is.
Okay, and there are multiple systems of redundancy usually, are there?
Absolutely, yes. So down the steering flat for each, so the Aratiri has twin rudders. They're a high-spec rudder, and they would have two steering motors for each rudder. So there'd be four steering motors down aft, and then also in the control systems up on the bridge, you would have an A and a B control system. Then there is a backup called an NFU, non-follow-up, and then on top of that there's an emergency steering system. The emergency steering system is activated down at the steering flap itself, and that involves manual stimulation of the solenoids. So that's quite an intricate operation and can't be done instantaneously.
Okay, so we can assume that both of the A and B or 1 and 2 systems that you talked about in the bridge, is that the sort of like the electronic or the software-based linkage where autopilots can be engaged and things like that. Just trying to sort of map it out in my head.
Simplistically, yes, that's correct. The two independent systems and the autopilot can link into either one of them. And generally, I would expect that they would use, say, system A on the southbound trip and system B on the northbound trip, or they may alternate them on a daily basis or a weekly basis as to which system is operating, so that each system is always tested functionality.
Okay, so the sailing through the sounds, and what would it be? Just like they go to make a position change at the helm, and nothing happens.
I don't want to second guess there. I'm not. I haven't seen the timeline. I don't know. It appeared to be a straight line, so it might have just veered off or sheared off, and then might have gone into helm into hand steering, or they may have already been in hand steering, and put more port helm on. Nothing happened. They might have flicked from A to B. Nothing happened. Then they might have flicked to NFU, and if nothing happened there, at some stage or other during those tests, they would have put the main engine astern. But got to be aware that once the engine's going astern, then you lose steerage way, because rudders require propulsion, forward momentum to have a water flow over the rudder to have an effect. So as soon as those engines were gone astern, when I realised they were heading towards the bricks, then any movement astern of the engines would have negated any any rudder input.
Right, gotcha. From the pictures you've seen, we've all seen the pictures, and the way the vessel is sitting on those rocks, and we know it's kind of fjords down there, so there's no gentle sloping, seabed up to the rocks. It's usually quite a depth, not far from the rocks. The way it sort of ended up, what does that tell you?
Without looking at the track, and I have to say I haven't seen the track, so it would have been initially a slow veering or shearing away from the original course, and it looks like she's almost come 90 degrees or 70 degrees from that original course. Would have started off slowly and would have sped up. The rate of turn would have sped up as she progressed. As I said, she'll be slowing down, the engine's going astern, but the way and the momentum of the turn would have been maintained, and short of actually going full astern on the port engine and possibly full ahead on the starboard engine to screw the vessel around. And we're talking a very short time period here, probably 90 to 120 seconds. It's very difficult to second guess what went on the bridge, and I don't really want to speculate on actions of the bridge team.
No, fair enough. Okay, so by the way, it was sort of positioned on the rocks. Can we anticipate damage? And they're reporting minor damage, it's still watertight, but there's got to be some sort of damage from, I mean, it's a heavy vessel, right? There's a lot of weight arriving on the rocks with momentum.
Oh, yes, there would be. I've seen that sort of damage when the Rena hit the bricks at 17 knots, and that was 40% of the length of the vessel was high and dry on the rocks there. There would certainly be hull impact damage and structural damage to the longitudinals, the transverse structure of the vessel in that area. It may have been negated slightly by the shelving of the seabed was relatively similar to the vessel's draft at the time, and if the seabed was sandy, muddy, or rocky. So a rock obviously could put a significant indentation into the hull and might have pierced the hull, but unlikely. The fact that the vessel is at anchor safely, then it's unlikely that any piercing of the inner hull, that's what we call the double bottoms, it's likely they remained intact. So that's your secondary barrier to flooding.
In these situations, what inspection regime, maintenance, has to be carried out on a vessel that's gone through this? How extensive is it? Can it be done while it's still afloat, or does it have to be put in dry dock? What are they in for, do you think?
They'd likely do the first survey by divers, and from the press reports that we've heard, they've had already been divers inspecting the hull. Then they might do an ROV survey. An ROV is a small submarine remote operated vehicle. They might use that to get measurements and do a swim up and down the hull to determine the extent of the damage. And the advantage of ROV, they get good quality, high quality video recording. And then between class, Maritime New Zealand, they will determine the level of repairs. and likely she will have to be dry dock to get those repairs undertaken. They certainly can't be the looking at the photos. They certainly won't be able to undertake those repairs while the vessel is afloat.
So it's going to be out of service for a period. Is there any way fast? I mean, what's the wait time? Because we don't have dry docks here. We used to have one in Wellington. You used to see the ferries in it, you know, driving into town when I was younger.
That's right. The floating dock used to be a wonderful sight to see, yes.
Yeah. It used to always, fascinate me. But that's long gone. I think it's at the bottom of an ocean somewhere. They're towing it somewhere and it sank. Anyway.
That's correct. Yes, it sunk in the Tasman Sea. Yep.
There you go. So there's something for someone to find later on. So where does it have to go? I guess the closest capability would be Australia, would it?
That's correct. I think she will fit in the dry dock in Sydney. There is a dry dock in Brisbane that she possibly could fit into as well, Cairns Cross dry dock. Other than that, it could be Singapore. So whichever of those docks you go to, obviously Singapore's a long way away, but they all have they're all booked out well in advance. So Inter Islander would have to pull some strings to try and get an emergency docking, and they do. Most operators are fairly amenable to altering schedules to accommodate emergency dry dockings in these situations.
Is it a long job or is it a few days? Do we know?
No, we don't. We don't know until those surveys are done, and then assuming that the ballast tanks in that area are watertight, then they'll be probably pumping them out and do an internal survey as well to find out the extent of the damage, and only then will they determine what would be the way ahead and the time and the dollar value for repairs.
I've seen a few people make comments like, lucky this didn't happen out in the Cook Strait in a southerly gale. I mean, that sounds like it could have ended in a disaster, though the Waihini sunk right at the entrance to the harbour, right, in Wellington.
Yeah, that's correct. When things go wrong at sea, it's actually the safest place to be. Deep sea is a wonderful place to be. You can't hit anything. So, albeit that the Cook Strait is a nasty piece of weather and she would have gone beam on, she could have, in deep sea in Cook Strait, she hadn't lost power like that vessel that hit the bridge in Baltimore. So she could have maintained heading into the swell using engines without rudders and also using her bow thrusters to maintain, or could have put stern into the weather. So these people that are talking about, oh, good thing it didn't happen in Cook Strait, it would have been better that it happened in Cook Strait. She wouldn't have gone aground. So obviously it's part of their risk management that they have between Tory Channel and Picton, that they pass close to two hard bits of land, and that's part of their route. That's a risk that they have assessed and managed. A deep sea, Cook Strait, is a far better place for a breakdown to occur than close to land.
Okay. Last question. I know you weren't there, but you've been on plenty of bridges in your time. Have you had a steering failure before in your career?
No, I haven't. No, I've been very lucky. I've had minimal mechanical, serious mechanical failures in my career, actually.
What would the feeling have been on that bridge? I guess it takes a few moments to get with what's going on, but you see that the rocks are there and you're close and you're heading that way. It must be a bit of a sinking feeling for everyone.
Yes, indeed. And I don't envy the any of the bridge team that were on there at the time. Imagine, put in perspective that the average person can understand. You're driving down the in a road, not on the motorway. You're driving down a bit of suburban street and your car at 50 k's, and all of a sudden you lose your steering. Your steering wheel comes off, or a linkage in your steering is gone, and you've got several seconds to realize what's happened. Nothing's happening, and then you're going to be veering off to the left or to the right. Then you put your brakes on, but there's a lot of things you do automatically, and the bridge team are pretty well trained, but there is a delay in assessing it. Right, it's not responding to the helm. Test the other system. It's still not responding to the helm, Captain. Put it to NFU. Still not responding. So there'd be a sequence of things they would do, and then there'd be a decision somewhere in that decision making process to start going to stern, knowing that there'd be no that impacts the ability to steer. So I would think we were We're lucky insofar as that it was a T-bone impact, we call, by putting the sharp end, the bow of the ship, up on the bricks. That's the strongest part of the ship, and it has a collision bulkhead there, extra strength for collisions. Whereas if she'd had a sideways glance like the Wahine, when she had a sideways one and it ripped open the hole down below, same as the Titanic. If the Titanic had hit directly onto the iceberg, she might not have. She might not have sunk, but the fact that she had a glancing blow and ripped four watertight sections open, then that sealed her doom. So it was beneficial. If you're going to hit anything, if you're going to go aground, go bow first.
And then you've got to make the PA announcement. Sorry, we're having a slight problem right now, you know, however you frame it. But, yeah.
And then whatever happens, you've got all the armchair admirals and the bathtub bosuns second-guessing every decision that you've made. Likewise, Maritime New Zealand, why did you do this, Captain? Why didn't you do that? And so I don't envy those poor boats that were on the bridge. And all of these resident experts have got to think, well, given the timeline, what would they have done? And if you think of the movie with Tom Hanks, where the pilot put the plane into the Hudson
Sully.
River,
yeah,
he had a very minimum time to make that decision and very professional and made the right call. Yet afterwards, that movie with Tom Hanks, they were trying to crucify the poor bastard, and he did everything right.
Yep. And he came through in the end.
He did in the end, yeah.
And given the discussion we had a year ago or so, just an opinion on this, does our Maritime Safety Authority have the capability and expertise to do a proper investigation of this? I guess they can outsource stuff that they can't work on, but I just wonder what your view on, or maybe you don't have a view on that, what it could be.
Do, but most of it on the radio. And initial answer to your question is no, they don't have the knowledge, capability, or experience. Transport Accident Investigation Commission do. I know one of the lead investigators there. He's not there anymore, but they do have good quality people. So I'm sure that the full full and comprehensive report will come out accurately and ascertain that the events that occurred and the steps that were taken. But there'll be criticism of what was or what wasn't done. I can only say that those people that level that criticism, you weren't there. The people that were there on the bridge made the decision that they thought was the right decision with the information that they had at the time. So anybody that levels criticism at professional seafarers like that is that, hey, you weren't there.
Fair enough. Captain Kevin Judkins, I appreciate so much that you came back to RCR and gave us a professional captain's view on this. I know it's early days, but I think you took us through it really well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Appreciate the time.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.